السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. InshaAllah, this lecture will act as a preliminary to tomorrow's lecture, or a preface, an introduction. If one observes their surroundings, one will notice that everything is in the process of moving. Everything. There's nothing motionless around us. Even the mountains, things that look stationary, it's in the process of becoming. From soil to copper, for example. From soil to gold, from soil to silver and other metals, what it may take millions of years. Or the growth of plants may take a shorter time. But everything is in the process of moving. Moving to where? That's one question. And this journey of movement, in the Irfani language, it's called deen. It's a code of obedience. And deen means obedience. They're following a code of obedience. Whatever it is, it's in the process of moving from potentiality to actuality. An apple seed moves moment to moment until it becomes an apple tree. Everything around us, if one looks with precision, everything is moving. Atoms, electrons, everything is moving. Smaller than electrons, smaller than that. Keep on going. There's always something smaller. Keep eternally. And there's always something bigger, eternally. There's no end. Everything is moving. Moving towards what? It's moving towards their destination. For example, with everything, the destination is different. With the apple seed, they're moving to become an apple tree. When they become an apple tree, they've reached their perfection. They die. They've become perfect. Then they're used, they die, and then it rots and decays, and now it's a new thing. And that decay now is in the process of becoming and keeps on moving. Apple tree is used by us, we consume it, and then it's used in another way, for example. Humans too. The same principle applies from an embryo to the human. It's always in the process of moving, and right now we're moving to what is our destination. We're always in the process of becoming, potentiality to actuality, moment to moment, hour after hour, day after day. That which applies to both us and the apple seed and other things is that this movement is inevitable and it's predestined. We had no choice in the matter. This movement that everything is experiencing, including humans, it's moving towards something, and this movement is predestined. It's moving towards actuality, it's moving towards perfection, more and more perfection, but this route to perfection is predestined. We had no choice in the matter. Now the apple seed, in its root, along its deen to become an apple tree, there may be other parameters at stake. It may not get to that stage or in that ideal state of an apple tree because of other parameters which may interfere. But whatever the parameters are, based on those parameters, it leads to its own perfection. It may be less than other apple seeds. Human beings too, they're going towards perfection. And the journey to perfection is predestined, be you Muslim or non-Muslim, be you male or female, good or bad, everyone is moving towards perfection. But there may be parameters here. We have this extra free will, and with that, we may become more and perfect, become more and more perfect, either in virtue, or we may become more and more perfect in vice. When the thief wants to steal that day, if you were to tell him, why do you want to steal? Underlying his inner intention is, I want to get more perfection. I want to be more perfect. I want to be more happy. I want to continue thriving. But the decision was wrong. But the quest to perfection hasn't changed at all. But it's perfection in vice. Like that apple seed, which doesn't grow normally. But there, the interfering parameters are different with humans. It's that free will. That's one important parameter. In our quest to perfection, we all have it. But we may err in reaching perfection in virtue. And rather, we reach and attain to perfection in vice. That's possible. But you can never escape. You can never escape. It's impossible. It's predestined. You can't say, I'm not after perfection. If anyone does say that, that's not a normal psychology. Okay. Now, this perfection, what is it? Here we have to use our app. It's a long process. But in short, when one sees the different varying degrees of perfection of different things around you, you keep on going after more things which are perfect. You start with a house, a car. Some people may stop at the Ferrari, but some people do and look for more perfect things. Education, university, seminary studies, holy books, holy prophets. And some people may even go higher and find rationally that which is perfect and unlimited in all aspects, and that is pure existence. Pure existence. How did you find that? An unbiased rational mind took me to something by the name of pure existence. What do you mean existence? How do you know existence is? Well, I started with these things around me, all these things around me, the car, the house, the plants, the books, the prophets. These are existing beings. But they varied in their degrees of perfection. I have a rational mind. I'm after perfection. It's predestined within me. My rationality hasn't erred yet. I'm after absolute perfection, if there is such a thing. And I've come to this new phenomenon. It's pure existence. And whatever is, emanates from it. Nothing can be existence-less. Nothing can be Allah-less. And all these infinite things that we see around us, since it stems from existence, it means existence has all the attributes of perfection. All the attributes of perfection, but those attributes of perfection that pure existence has manifest in these different things that we see in varying degrees. But when we see all these varying degrees of perfection, it all emanates from that pure existence. That absolute perfection. The apple seed become, now that pure existence, let's call it Allah. Allah is a name. What the theologians call Allah, the philosophers call pure existence. That apple seed wants to become Khalifatullah. Khalifa means a successor. Not only a socio-political successor. It means a successor succeeding the predecessor's attributes too. Amir al-Mu'mineen had his 16 attributes of the Holy Messenger, for example. That's why he's called a Khalifa. Humans are all things. or Khalifatullah, but to varying degrees. So even the apple seed is Khalifatullah to X degree. How much can it manifest those attributes of perfection, of absolute perfection? How much can it exhibit, display those attributes? To that degree it's Khalifatullah. Animals, plants. But with humans, since the potential to manifest those attributes of perfection, of that absolute perfection, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of pure existence, since humans can manifest it more, they become the most strong in relation to becoming Khalifatullah. And therefore, everything else's Khilafah is under their auspices. So that's the potential that we have. And we're moving in that direction too. But we may mess it up. Ya ayyuha al-insan, innaka kadihun ila rabbik kadha. O man, verily you are striving laboriously towards your Lord. A thorough striving. Famulari. Therefore you'll meet him. Famulari. That meeting absolute perfection is something we will all unite with. Uniting with Allah is something inevitable. It just, that journey has to continue. And after death, physical death in this realm, this moving is still going to continue. There's no end to it. But with which attributes of Allah you're going to unite with, that depends on your actions. Are you going to be a recipient of His wrath, His anger, revenge, His beauty, compassion, love? That depends on you. But we're all going to unite with Him. So the quest to perfection is a quest of pure existence. First we have to acknowledge it. That which is absolute perfection is pure existence. Now let's give it a name. Before giving the name, your guide was your rationality. Now you found it. Let's give it a name. Allah, God, whatever. But first we have to acknowledge it. The beholder of all attributes of perfection is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Pure existence. Doesn't have a beginning. Doesn't have an end. Nothing is independent from it. That's our first objective in acknowledging it. Now, after acknowledging it, we want to build a relationship with it. Incorporate its attributes more and more to acquire a proximity. The more pure existence-like we become, the more proximate we become with that absolute perfection. And then eventually we can even be it to X degree. Seeing it, acknowledging it, seeing it, being Allah-like, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, how? How can we reach that state? Being Allah-like, that's the objective. Those states of the Holy Messenger, of Amir al-Mu'mineen, those godly states, we have access to that too. That, in the Irfani language, is called the haqiqa of deen. Allah Ta'ala says that's the fruit, that's the objective. To get to that thing, you have to succeed in the tariqa, which is the noble ethical traits. I'll come to that in a minute. And to succeed in the tariqa, you have to succeed in the sharia, the letter of the law. When I say noble ethical traits, when I say forgiving, being patient with, and other noble ethical traits that exist, You may say that others have that too. Non-Muslims have that too. Some people may even be born with a stronger predisposition to manifest patience and forgiveness of a very high degree. Is that of value? Of course not. No, it is, but not what we're looking for. That forgiveness, that patience, and those other noble ethical traits that are a key to reach Allah, it has to be done through Tawheed. Then, if that's the case, and I'll explain that in a minute, if that's the case, then you can't say, well, a non-Muslim has that too. That which a non-Muslim has, it's a genetic, they have a stronger predisposition to that because of the way their parents were, for example. They don't get as angry as easily as others, for example. Even amongst Muslims, the same applies. That's not a value. The value is when these traits have been nurtured through Tawheed. Because these traits may be nurtured through other than Tawheed, like genetically, for example. And the difference is, with one of them, you're acquiring a proximity with Allah, as with the other, you're not. You're acquiring a proximity with the ego. The way one acquires the noble ethical traits through Tawheed, the key is undergoing burdens. Not that we're praying for burdens. We don't pray for burdens. We pray for a good life, good health, good wealth, good family, and so on and so forth. That's our door. A normal psychology would want that. But when burdens come our way, we deal with them properly. And if we deal with burdens through Tawheed, we can slowly but surely acquire those noble ethical traits and get closer and closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In one verse of the Holy Quran, وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ وَالْجُوءِ وَنَقْسٍ مِّنَ الْأَمْوَالِ وَالْأَنفُسِ وَالثَّمَرَاتِ. We will most definitively test you with something of fear or hunger, a loss of wealth, a loss of life, food. We're going to definitely test you. Why is it a definite? Because we said this movement was predestined. That's going to happen anyway, the moving. Now, along this moving, whether you're going to move towards perfection of vice or virtue, the burdens will help you here. So you must be given that opportunity. We're going to test you with a loss of something. We're going to make you scared. How are you going to deal with it? We're going to make you hungry. We're going to make you experience a loss of wealth, a loss of health, and so on and so forth. How are you going to deal with it?
وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ.
Give glad tidings to the patient ones. Who are they? Not someone whose father was patient and they've acquired that trait. That they are patient, but it's not the patience that Allah wants. It's of benefit, even of worldly benefit, but that patience won't help them in the hereafter.
وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ الَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَتْهُمْ مُصِيبَةٌ.
Those who, the patient ones, those who, when a burden encounters them, قَالُوا إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. The slogan of Tawheed. Verily, we're all Allah's. Nothing is existence-less. And we're all returning there. We're all uniting. Famolari. We're all going to unite with Him. Which attributes that's in our hands? It's pure Tawheed. That the patient ones, when the burden comes, through Tawheed, they deal with the burdens. This is of value. Not through inherited traits. The difference being, the patient one who inherited it, and the patient one who had that patience. They may be genetically very angry people or impatient people, but that very impatient person who, let's say, acquired that impatience from whoever, through Tawheed becomes patient. The difference is they will become closer to Allah. Their Tawheed will become stronger and stronger. They'll get closer and closer to absolute perfection. So, two things have to be raised here. First, this process of getting closer to Tawheed through burdens, how is it? And two, what's the practical protocol? Okay, what's the practical protocol for this to happen? I've mentioned it in general terms, the noble ethical traits, but let's go a bit finer into this. That I'll answer tomorrow. Tonight, only this, the process. What's happening exactly when we are encountered with a burden? And how does that enhance our Tawheed? What is it doing to us? Or, depending on how we react, what is it not doing to us? Let's say someone steals something from you. That example of loss of wealth, for example. They steal something from you. You get disappointed. It's a natural reaction. The question is, why did you get disappointed? All forms of disappointment should be traced back to Tawheed. All forms of disappointment. And all forms of spiritual illnesses. The cure is in Tawheed. The cause is also in the lack of Tawheed. Why did you get disappointed when you lost your wealth? The answer is because you said, my wealth. You believed that that wealth was yours. Why did you get disappointed when your offspring passed away? Or your wife passed away, or your spouse, because you said, my offspring. You believed it was your offspring. You believed it was your spouse. It was your house. My money, my job, my certificate. Where in reality, none of it was yours. You constructed these, this ownership, this job, this leadership role, this family, having spouses, having children, marriage, these are mental constructs. And it's important because without them, that initial movement towards perfection can't happen as easier as with them. That initial movement we were speaking about, which is predestined, that has to be done in peace and harmony. And therefore, we say, let's assign this mental construct of ownership so that we can say, this is my land, so no one can take it from us. We can live in peace and harmony and then reach our goal towards perfection. The same with the spouse, the same with the job, the same with the certificate, knowledge. But these are all mental constructs. They don't exist in reality. There's nothing known as ownership in the external world. There's nothing known as marriage. These are mental constructs. We assign them, and Allah has ordained them, for this one purpose, for you to reach that perfection of yours in virtue in the best possible manner. But what happens over a period of time is you forget that quest towards perfection, and the means, those mental constructs, they become the goal. And then you pose and boast of your spouses, children, your job, your prestige, your knowledge, your land, being an owner, This is the worldly life. A collection of all these things, that's the worldly life. Etebarot, mental constructs. You see, it's swapped, everything's swapped now. You've lost the goal, you've lost the objective. Then you become drowned in these things. And all these things are imaginative because none of it is yours. And that's why there's tradition that say that people are asleep. When they die, then they wake up to this reality. For the 70, 80, 100 years, I was asleep in this dunya. I was drowned in the worldly life. I kept on saying, my spouse, my family, my job, my this, my that. When none of it was mine. But I was drowned in it, and it bothered me from reaching my goal. That objection of mine, objective. That quest to absolute perfection. Now, how can one evaluate oneself in how much one is succeeding or how much one is not succeeding? You can do this in many of your daily activities. You can analyze them a bit deeper. For example, if you were to write a book or an essay and then someone steals it and then publishes it in their name, how disappointed will you become? No one is saying don't retaliate and get your right. But are you angry in this process or not? If you're angry and disappointed, it's because you attributed that knowledge to yourself, whereas all knowledge is Allah's. You attributed to yourself as if you got it independent from Allah, deep down. Whereas, if you had seen it all as Allah's, and you did it for Allah's sake, the writing, seeing yourself as manifesting Allah's attribute of knowledge, then even if they steal it, it won't affect you. Because you know Allah knows. It doesn't bar you from your journey towards perfection, getting closer and closer to Allah's knowledge. Just because a certificate is to say you have this knowledge, or a piece of paper is to say you don't have this knowledge, has no bearing on reality. And that was you, in your quest to absolute perfection, manifesting Allah's knowledge. But you were manifesting it. You never attributed it to yourself. Or for example, you give a speech and then they attack you for that speech, or they praise you for that speech. If they praise you and you get happy, that's also being drowned. Well, why are you being happy? Is it because it's enhancing your ego? Why should you be happy? You did it for Allah's sake. You're manifesting Allah's knowledge. None of that knowledge is yours. None of it was acquired by you independent from Allah. So why do you get happy? Yes, you can get happy if it gets you closer to Allah, but not because of someone's praise. Actually, that can lead you to self-conceit. You invite someone to your house, they never invite you. You feel you've been disrespected. See? You feel you've been disrespected. They never invited you back. You invited them. Did you do it for Allah's sake? Or for your ego's sake? The fact that you get disappointed, you feel as if your izzah and your honor has been compromised. But if you were of the belief that إِنَّ الْإِزَّةَ لِلَّهِ جَمِيعًا, only Allah can grant honor, only Allah can take honor away from you, it doesn't matter what other people say. This point of izzah becomes very difficult when the dishonoring becomes higher. A small dishonoring, a petty dishonoring, if you have a bit of tawheed, you can sort that easily. That's it. Allah knows. Honest with Allah, that's easy. But when the dishonoring becomes mighty, becomes heavy, you need a stronger tawheed now. Because a heavy dishonoring targeted against you, for example, people in the community are speaking against you, whether it's false or it's true. But the thing is, a strong tawheed will tell you, these people can't grant me honor, and these people can't take honor from me. Is it possible? Because honor is Allah's, all of it. You see? Honor is Allah's. Looking for honor outside the jurisdiction of Allah is impossible. Because we said it's pure existence. It's impossible to find anything outside pure existence. It has no beginning, it has no end. It's infinite. You're looking in the wrong place. It's all imagination, this honor of yours. You're building it for yourself. You're building the dunya within yourself. It's all a game. It's all an amusement, play. And it's all deviating you from your in your quest towards absolute perfection. Or for example, you did some community work, you helped out, and you put some effort into something, they didn't thank you. Okay, but then you built a hospital, you feel you weren't being respected enough. I did this, I built this hospital, I participated in it. It was my money, it was my this, if it wasn't for me, this would happen, that would happen. These people are drowned in the world in life. See, deep down, the tawheed is very, very low. It's a very low tawheed they have. Their tawheed is a theoretical, God is one, not two. Finished. There's no practical element to it. Otherwise, they would never think like this. As if that power was theirs independently. That money was theirs, the wealth was theirs. But in the Quwwata, the Lajamiya, in the Quran, that power, none of it was yours. It was all Allah's. You attributed it to yourself. This attributing power, honor, wealth, spouse, prestige, this, all these attributings to yourself, these are false attributings. They're pseudo-attributings. A collection of these pseudo-attributings, we say, it's called the dunya. And this dunya is within. It's not the mountains and sun and moon. That's samawat wal ard. Dunya in the Quran is within you. Those itibarat, those false attributings. And the more you incorporate those false attributings, the more falsehood you're incorporating within you, the more void you're incorporating within you. It's all imagination. It's all khiyal. It's all khiyalat. None of it is real. It's all within. It's all in your mind. Your position, your honor, everything, your spouse is there. It's all in your mind. And tawheed, you're empty of it. But with through tawheed, when you do a good deed for the community, irrespective of whether they thank you or not, that takes you closer to Allah, because you're manifesting His power, and you don't attribute anything to yourself. Inna al-quwwata lillah jamia. When someone disrespects you, it doesn't matter. Allah grants honor. You did it for Allah's sake. You didn't get disappointed. And keep on going one by one, and then keep on analyzing these deeds. So it all depends on how you regard ownership, how much do you, and the other mental constructs, how much do you say that it wasn't mine. This depends on your tawheed. It depends on your khulus. How much khulus do you have? I did X action for Allah's sake. This for Allah's sake. It's important. It helps you get rid of the mental constructs. Do it for Allah, so you see Him as the source of power, wealth, offspring, prestige, honor, and so on and so forth. Do it for Allah's sake. So you need some tawheed. You have to realize that wal awwal wal akhir wal dahir wal batin. You have to realize this. It has to be incorporated. How? We'll speak about that tomorrow. It has to be incorporated, though. Then you sing another with a smile. Doesn't matter. Let me continue with my duty. I did X action for Allah's sake. Here, we are mukhlis here. Present participle. But we are mukhlis. And we keep on doing this in relation to our daily actions. The more the better. The more we succeed in being mukhlis, this present participle, the more we succeed, the more and more we become mukhlis, and since we've dedicated our actions to Allah. However, we can't be 100% mukhlis yet. Because even if all our actions are done for Allah's sake, at the end of the day we still say, I did X action for Allah's sake. There's still an I. And you're still attributing it, the action, to the I. And the Allah too is not the real thing. It can't be the real thing because you're still in the process of attributing things to yourself. But with a lot of ikhlas and being a mukhlis in a very high degree and exhibiting your love for Allah through this ikhlas, eventually Allah will make you mukhlas. The past participle now. Where the I is slaughtered. You can't slaughter it because you have this self-love for the I, the ego. But Allah takes it away from you. When Allah takes it away, now you become mukhlas. Subhanallah amma yasifun. Immaculate is Allah. Free is Allah from that which they attribute to Him. Illa ibadallahi mukhlasin. Mukhlasin. Except for the servants, it's a poor mukhlas. They can attribute things to Allah because they're seeing the real thing. For us, we may experience moments of being mukhlas, moments. Some people even more moments. But the minimum to infallibility is being mukhlas. But being mukhlas has stages too.
One verse of the Holy Quran. وَإِذَا ذُكِرَ اللَّهُ وَحْدَهُ.
When Allah is mentioned alone,
اشْمَعَزَّتْ قُلُوبُ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ.
Those who, the hearts of those who don't believe in Akhira, it shrinks with aversion. It's too pure for them to do something for Allah alone. However, if you want to do something for Allah, but also to get a benefit, for people to love you, to go to heaven, for an illness to go, for your honor to increase, for your wealth to increase, you're doing final two, but you're getting benefit today.
وَإِذَا ذُكِرَ الَّذِي ذُكِرَ الَّذِينَ مِن دُونِهِ.
When things other than Allah too are mentioned, here they become very happy.
إِذَا هُمْ يَسْتَبْشِرُونَ.
Immediately they become very happy. Yes, if you want to do it. They're rejoicing here. That's easy for them, yes. Because there's a benefit they're getting from it. The khulus is not pure. He said to you, oh, forgive this brother. Forgive him. And you say, they did it for Allah's sake. No. You did me wrong. And say, when you do forgive him, then we'll give this to you. We'll do this for you. His brother will help you in that. They do it immediately. This min dunihi, other than Allah, when that's mentioned, these are idols. Whatever stops you from rejoicing in Allah's name alone, and then using Allah as a means to something else, that thing is an idol. Innamal mushrikeen, innamal mushrikuna, najasun. This mushrik, it's not only the mushrik which says X person is God, it's even applies to concealed shirk, where you're using God as a means to something else. This is also, you're a mushrik. And إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَغْفِرُ أَن يُشْرَكَ بِهِ. Allah's not going to forgive anyone who exercises shirk to Him. And it's not only the open form of shirk by saying X is God, even concealed shirk. You're not going to be covered. You're not going to be forgiven. You're contaminating yourself. Every action of concealed shirk that you do. So, with Tawheed, it helps us. When the burdens come, it teaches us how to lessen, bit by bit, traces of concealed shirk. Bit by bit. Until the ikhlas becomes maxima. And then it's in Allah's hands when He's going to slaughter the eye for us to enter into the domain of the mukhlasin. And if we're going to be drowned in the dunya, I'll just go through this verse of the Quran too. In relation to Iblis, the verse it says that he's waiting, he's doing nothing, just waiting. ثُمَّ لَأَتِيَنَّهُمْ مِنْ بَيْنَ أَيْدِيهِمْ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِمْ وَعَنْ أَيْمَانِهِمْ وَعَنْ شَمَائِلِهِمْ. He's waiting. Then something happens. Then he will most definitely come forth from your front, from your back, from your right side, from your left. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has gone through these. Each of these have a meaning. Coming from your left is, first of all, you forget Allah. That's why Iblis comes your way. To the degree and proportion you forget Allah during the day, that the degree of temptations increase. Satanic temptations. If you never forget Allah, the satanic temptations won't come. But he comes in different ways. This forgetting Allah will be manifested by Iblis to you, upon you, in different ways. Coming from your left is when you're predominated by shahwa, your sexual appetite, your nutritional appetite, all these things, you're more and more animal-like. Coming from your right has one meaning, coming from your front, all these, some of them are very delicate. I need more time then to explain those. But coming from behind is when you amass wealth for your inheritors. About the idea of amassing a lot of wealth for your children, it can be so spiritually crippling to you, as if you're attributing the child to yourself, the money to yourself. My child, my money, your daughter, my inheritors. It's all dunya, it's all Iblis working. Spend your money. Spend it in Allah's way, in this dunya. We don't have this idea of amassing wealth, especially for such purposes. And then we have the whole idea of insurance for our children, for our grandchildren. It's all the dunya bring. Whereas sometimes you're living on a daily basis. You have tawakkul upon Allah. This system of insurance and loans and all this is crippling the tawakkul. You're feeling more and more independent now. Once in Mombasa, in Kenya, I was teaching at a school. In Mombasa. Opposite the school, there was a garden. And there was this person lying down in the garden. He seemed very poor. He would even go into the earth, dig and eat, rub what seems like rubbish, would consume it. So, after a few days, I think, let me go give him some money. So I took some money and gave to him. He didn't accept. He would say something in Swahili, but I wouldn't understand. The two brothers in that community who married local sisters there, and who could speak Swahili, the Iranians, but I went to them and said, "Look, it's incredible. This brother's not accepting anything from me." He said, "No, it's impossible. That can't be the case." I said, "Come on, you give him this money." And then he went. And I was looking from a distance, so that person didn't know, see me. And then that Kenyan brother rejected his hand too. But then this Iranian brother could understand what he was saying. He came to me and said, "No, he's not accepting." He said, "I have enough for today." Allahu Akbar. I didn't investigate this issue, or even go into his life or investigate, but it's a very good subject. That in that state, saying, "I don't need it." Wallah, it's stronger than my iman. Wallah, I'm saying it. It's incredible. In Mombasa, actually, you see, when you go to the marketplace and everything, people are living day after day. In other third world countries too. I'm not saying it's good to be poor. I'm not saying it's good to be a third world country. No. Okay. But we have tests in the first world countries. They have their own tests. Each one has their own test. But it seems their tawakkul is much stronger. We're not given in the West, we're not given room space to develop tawakkul. From the very beginning, everything is provided for us. As if the next 50, 60, 70 years, it's all been programmed. That kills you spiritually. In the other countries, they have their own tests. But we have to be careful. And then, after that verse, I started off in the very beginning, about giving the test. Allah will test you, definitely. The next verse, إِنَّ السَّفَا وَالْمَرْوَى مِنْ شَعَائِرِ اللَّهِ. Safa and Marwa are the slogans of Allah. Now some people, commentators of the Quran, say that this is a start of a new section of that chapter, the Ura for Sina. This is a key. It's a code. Safa and Marwa holds the key to how to deal with those burdens through Tawheed. And here we have to go through the bodily meanings of Safa and Marwa and how it's related to that verse. And there they go through the story of Dhulqarnayn. And what the inner body aspects of that story is, inshallah, we'll do it tomorrow. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala Tawheed. During the last few nights, we've been going through the poems of Oman Salmani. In relation to Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam, he's written very little, a few pages. Since I couldn't get to the bottom of it, I can't read it. Because usually I have to understand it myself before I share it. If I don't, I don't bother. It's dangerous. You may have questions after. Yes, with Hazrat Abbas, the things he's saying, I couldn't digest it. It was very heavy. So So because of that, with your permission, I'll go through the standard maktabs and what they say in relation to Hazrat Abbas and the Deir Roshud. Shimr, like I told you, fought on Ali's side, alayhi salam, in the Battle of Siffin in the year 40 after Hijrah, alongside Imam Hussein. But in the year 61 after Hijrah, things were reversed. Shimr went to Karbala. On exploring the status quo, he reported back to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, the governor of Kufa, with two letters. The first letter, he said to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad that this Umar ibn Sa'd is talking with Hussein behind the curtains. He wants to gain authority of Ray, the city of Ray, and simultaneously wants to lay a route of escape for Hussein so that Hussein does not die. On receiving this letter, Ubaydullah got furious and sent a letter to Umar ibn Sa'd stating, on receiving this letter, you either get his allegiance or you finish him off. Otherwise, the city of Ray will go to Shim. When Umar ibn Sa'd read the letter, he exclaimed to Shim, damn you, I wanted to finish matters in peace. Why did you have to ruin things? Now I'm forced to actively engage in battle with Hussein alayhi salam, and kill him. In Shimr's second letter to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, the governor of Kufa, here Shimr informed Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad that look, Abbas ibn Ali is of the same tribe as me, Bani Kilab, they're fighters. Abbas is a difficult barrier to overcome. We have to try and convince him to flee the scene, to flee Karbala. Then Hussein will in effect be finished. So on the night of Ashura, Shimr went to the area where Imam Hussein's tent was erected and shouted out loud, "Oh Abbas," Shimr shouted out loud, "Oh Abbas, I want a word with you and your brothers. Come out." Now Abbas being in the tent with Imam Hussein, with his master, alayhi salam. In the presence of Imam Hussein, Abbas felt embarrassed. Imam Hussein said, go and see what they want from you. Abbas left and came face to face with Shimr. On telling Abbas of his plans, Abbas felt angry and cursed Shimr. I am Hussein's slave, Abbas exclaimed, and left and returned to the tents of his master. Imam Hussein was there in the tent. Abbas was feeling more ashamed now. The Imam said, Abbas, what happened? I said, Abbas didn't want to say anything initially, but finally he uttered, they wanted to provide us with asylum. Imam Hussein, with utmost compassion, then said, they want my blood. Let your brothers go. You too, Abbas, can go. It's my blood thereafter. It was here that Abbas could no longer control himself and exploded into tears, crying, lamenting. He would never consider such a thing. Maybe he recalled the night of the 21st of Ramadan, the night of his father's martyrdom, Amirul Mu'mineen, when Amirul Mu'mineen summoned Hussein and Abbas together, put their hands into one another's, turned to Abbas and said, don't ever leave Hussein alone. Abbas was lamenting on hearing Hussein giving such an offer, and put Hussein's heart at rest and said, my mother was Zainab's slave and I yours. On the day of Ashura, Abbas saw all his brothers martyred, all of whom were Bani's sons. Abdullah, Uthman, Ja'far, all of the men of Ahlul Bayt were murdered. On the other side, he would hear the cries for water and the need for help from the women and children in the tents. He went to seek permission from Imam Hussein to enter the arena. Since Abbas's name and appearance was fearful for the enemy, The women were still relatively calm in the presence of Abbas. After all, he was the standard bearer. Hussein would tell Abbas, Ya akhi anta sahibu liwa'i. Brother, you're my standard bearer. Oh Abbas, Hussein would say, your martyrdom will end all things. Abbas replied, Qaddaqa sadri. My heart is in pain. Everything has a limit. These hypocrites have gone over the limit. My heart is hurting. Sami'tu min al-hayat. I'm satiated with life. وَأُولِيدُ أَنْ أَتْلُبَ الثَّارِي مِنْ هَؤُلَاءِ الْمُنَافِقِينَ. I want to retaliate for the blood spilled by these hypocrites. Imam saw these were the final moments of Abbas, who was after all satiated with life. Now you have this objective, Imam said, go ahead. But one thing, Abbas, فَاتْلُبْ لَهَؤُلَاءِ الْأَطْفَالِ قَلِيلًا مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِ. Prepare some water, a little water for these children. Abbas went to the Kufan army, trying to speak some sense into them, counseling them, advising them, but it was to no avail. He then turned to Umar ibn Sa'd and said, Hussein is the son of the Holy Prophet's daughter. You've killed all his companions and family members. His female family members and children remain. Please leave them. فَأَسْقُوهُمْ مِنَ الْمَاءِ أَحْرَقَ ثَمَرَ قُلُوبَهُمْ. This thirst is burning their insides. Why have you shut all access to water? Especially when the Imam is informing you that if you allow him to leave, he'll go wherever you want. Some soldiers started crying from the enemy camp, but Shem reversed the atmosphere without delay by shouting out loud, Yabna Abi Turab, Lo Kana Wajhul Ard, Kulluhu Ma'an, Wa Huwa Tahta Aydina, Lama Saghaynakum Minhu Qatratan Illa An Tadkhulu Fi Bay'ati Yazid. That if the surface area of the earth, all of it, was water, and you were in our control, it was all in our control, the water, we would never satiate you with any, even a drop of that water, until you enter the allegiance of Yazid. Abbas returned to give Hussein the latest. Meanwhile, the cries were increasing. Abbas couldn't stand for more. Zeal and anger drove him to mount his horse with a water container and go and search for some water. He approached the Euphrates to collect some water. All of a sudden, 4,000 arrowsmen surrounded him immediately and started firing their arrows at him now and again. But Abbas, without fear, he fought whoever challenged him. The flag of Islam was standing high. He filled the container. Before starting to return, he initially wanted to drink some of the water for himself, revitalizing himself for further battle. However, tadhakkara atashal Hussein. He discarded the water. He recalled Hussein's atash. On that of the children, Hussein's atash. What does this atash mean? He mounted his horse, ready to leave for the camp, where children and women were all waiting eagerly in anticipation. The attacks made towards Abbas were increasing. He combated them, defeated them accordingly. However, during the combats, two soldiers cowardly attacked him from behind. It was unexpected, and the two's maneuver led to the amputation of Abbas's right arm. Abbas continued, however, calling out loud, Wallahi in qata'tuhu yamini inni uhami abadan ad-dini. I swear by Allah, if you cut my right hand, I shall eternally support my religion. Wa an imam sadiq al-yamini najl al-nabi al-tahir al-amini, and support my trustworthy imam who is with yamin and who is the offspring of that pure and trustworthy messenger. Abbas wasn't saddened in the least. Water must be conveyed to the Ahlul Bayt. But similar cowardly attacks continued from behind until his left arm was amputated. Abbas was now holding onto the water container through the gripping of his teeth. Seeing Abbas helpless, the attacking arrows surrounded him more and more, and then started pouring the arrows at him. One hit the container, all the water leaving. One hit his chest. Things were looking grim. Hope in the water listened for the children and women of Bani Hashim. All of a sudden, someone came and struck Abbas's head with an iron bar, making him fall helplessly onto the ground from his horse. It was then that he called out to his brother, Alayka minni as-salam ya Abu Abdullah. Hussein came running to Abbas, and what a sight he had to see. Abbas, full of wooden arrows, no arms, face drowned and soaked in blood, no eyes to see, head smashed. It was the end of Abbas, and Hussein knew it. He exclaimed, Al-an an inkasara dhahri wa ghallat hilati. My back's broken and nothing is left for me.